Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it's a gorgeous day in Brooklyn. However, the electricity went out for a little bit at Roberta's. I'm being real here. So we're recording on, we're still recording. That's
like
all that matters.
A walkie-talkie.
Yeah, totally. My guest today is a trooper for dealing with this, and her name is Kristen McGlory. She is the executive editor at Food 52. Particularly the editor of the James Beard nominated column Genius Recipes on Food 52, and she is the editor of Genius Recipes, 100 recipes that will change the way you cook, and it is a gorgeous cookbook. Thanks so much for joining us here, Kristen.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this book, first of all, I just want to say that physically it feels substantial, it looks important, and it actually smells kind of nice too.
I haven't gotten close enough to smell it. I mean, I haven't thought about smelling it, but now
it might be my bookshelf. So this book, it just feels like, you know, this was a keeper if I was in a bookstore. Like, this feels like a good book. Is that how you felt kind of like about the recipes themselves?
That's really, really nice to hear. I mean, that's what I had hoped for. I mean, you know, a lot of the recipes in the series are these really, really iconic recipes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was kind of my goal, was to gather as many game-changing recipes as I could in one book. And, you know, a lot of them are fairly well-known, and some are less so. But just, like, the point being that it would be 100 kind of tricks to have in your back pocket, mm-hmm. Techniques that would change, like the subtitle says, change the way that you think about cooking something.
So it's like a revelation. Like, each one comes with like a nugget of knowledge that you can keep using and
putting into your food. Exactly. And in a lot of cases, it's a simplification or a shortcut, which mm-hmm. is really nice. But it doesn't always have to be. It's just the idea being that it's like different from the sort of standard way that you would think that everybody says that you have to do something. Or like, if you're kind of swimming around on the internet, like, oh my gosh, how do I roast a chicken? There's like a million techniques. Or, you know, I've always heard that like French chefs insist on trussing a certain way, that like, I kind of try to like wade through all of that and test as many of the sort of iconic versions of recipes that I can, and distill down what the one way is that I think you need to know.
Right. Well, we need definitely more of that, because some recipes are older and preferences change too. So
that's,
I imagine,
true.
That plays a lot into it. This book also reminds me sort of as like a scrapbook that people used to collect of their favorite recipes, and they'd clip them from here and there and put them together, because you've been doing this column, Genius Recipes, since like, what, 2012? Or so?
2011, I think. It's been 4 years, yeah.
Wow. So this is like a compendium of like the best of.
Yeah, it's half greatest hits from the column, and then half of the recipes are new to the book too. So
cool.
So yeah, it's I mean, we wanted to give people something that they hadn't already seen on the website. And also, I had all of these tips that I was kind of sitting on. I, just to go back for a second, I really rely heavily on tips from the Food 52 community and from, you know, just people out in the world, because I don't, like, even though I am sort of, like, shepherding these recipes through the column, I don't pretend to know everything about cooking by a long shot. Well, so it really, really helps to have tips from a huge, you know, well of the entire Food 52 community.
And I love how that you have that genius tips here kind of shout out at the end of this book, because a lot of the recipes are from, like, really famous chefs, amazing, amazingly acclaimed chefs and so forth. But you also have all these tips from your community at Food 52, like normal people.
Yeah, it's really been my favorite part about doing this whole thing, is that from the very first column I put up, you know, that one we sourced internally from, you know, it was
somebody,
a recipe that that Amanda Hesser, my boss at Food 52, had written about before, and she knew it was super genius. It was the River Cafe's strawberry sorbet that has a whole lemon chopped up and blended in, including the skin, the pith, everything. The only thing you lose is the seeds. It's so good.
Genius.
I know, your face is like,
that's genius.
It okay. No, really, right. Really. Like, it's really. It's, I mean, honestly, I teach classes sometimes at ICE, and that's been, like, I have to put that on anytime I teach a class in the summer, I have to make sure we do that, because every time it comes out so good and people are so shocked by it.
Wow.
And like, no matter who is doing it, like, it, no matter, like, what the strawberries are, like, you can adjust it to taste. You can add a little more sugar if they're kind of sour. If, you know,
gosh,
you can add more
lemon
juice.
I can really go for that.
It's really excellent. But anyway, I got that
especially
from Amanda.
Especially with no air conditioning right now.
I know.
That sounds wonderful. Give me more genius sorbets.
Yes. But after that, the community jumped in. Like, I've always had a line at the bottom of every column that said, send me your tips. And they have ever since. And so I definitely, like, I wouldn't have been able to do this without them.
Without them. Mm-hmm. Aw. Well, okay, so a little bit about your background, because you're the executive editor at Food 52. You've also graduated from ICE, the culinary, the international culinary Institute of Culinary Education.
That's it. That's the one.
And you also graduated from the NYU Food Studies program. Mm-hmm. But you had a background in economics. What was that all about?
What was that all about? It's a really good question. I just, like, I didn't really know that food was a thing that you could do. Like, really, I it's been a while since I graduated from college, but when, you know, I went to, like, a big liberal arts school, all the majors were, like, you know, you can major in English or history or engineering, and I picked econ, and I really liked learning about it, but then when I just had no idea what it was going to be like when I got into the job market, and it just didn't suit me. I didn't like it. I thought about food all the time, and so eventually, after kind of, like, sitting in my cubicle for a while, I just started Googling and found the food studies program at NYU, and eventually decided to pursue that.
Well, does anything about your background in economics, do you think, plays into your I don't know, choices, your, I don't know, anything about your cooking?
I'm sure that it must. Honestly, like, on a practical level, the thing that I use most is that, like, I know how to do spreadsheets pretty well, and so, like, I use that, you know, I, like, set up our editorial calendar and, like, those kinds of things in Google spreadsheets, and I'm pretty...
That's a good skill.
It's a skill. but I don't know about it. Like, I could maybe, like, I've sort of thought that, like, my, like, researchy side of, like, wanting to problem solve and figure out what's going on in something maybe has informed how I like to tackle, like,
the genius,
what's going on in a recipe, but I don't know.
Well, you're very modest, Kristen, but I have to say that if you have edited 100 genius recipes and countless others on this column beforehand, you must be pretty much the smartest person in cooking, so
no,
I thought, no.
Not by a long shot.
Okay, we'll find out. How's that?
Because
I have, well, I was joking earlier that I was going to shoot Kristen 52 rapid-fire questions, but I don't have quite that many questions, but shall we try a little?
Sure.
Okay, quiz game. All right, eggplant, salt and squeeze out to get rid of bitter juices, or is that a total myth?
Not a total myth. I think it helps mostly with getting rid of the moisture. I don't think it changes the flavor a ton, but I think it does help by getting some of the moisture out beforehand.
Okay, so yes, for a totally different reason. what temperature to roast Brussels sprouts?
Oh, I would say in the 400, 425 range.
Okay, nice and crispy.
Just, I think that's a, like, roast anything at that range, probably. 4 to 450, really.
All-encompassing, roast everything answer.
Yes.
400-something. Onions and marinara sauce, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. should we always blind bake pie crust? This is a little a genius trick where you bake the bottom crust first so it doesn't get soggy. Anyway, should we always do that because it's so genius?
Yes, but... This is a yes, but there is a pie in the book, a pumpkin pie. It's a custard pie that kind of defies all pie crust logic.
Okay,
and you just put it in raw, and then because you bake it at such a high temperature,
it's okay.
Like it crisps up the butt, especially if you use a glass pie pan.
Mm-hmm.
Those tend to, like, you know, the heat gets in pretty. Evenly, and you can monitor it a lot better. You can, like, see through, obviously, and see it's getting brown and crispy.
All right, so that's a good shortcut then. All right, so yes, but not for one pumpkin pie recipe in this book. Is it a sin to mix cheese and seafood, really?
Nothing's a sin. No.
I like that answer. All right. What is the most delicious and edible part of the... what is the most delicious and edible part of a food that we're constantly throwing away?
Oh my gosh, there's so many.
The most best.
Charred stems.
Charred stems of Swiss chard a la Anna Klinger at Alila.
A la Anna Klinger, she blanches and then grills them and then tosses them in anchovy dressing, which is delicious, but also... I recently put up a charred stock hummus from Tara Dugan of Root to Stock Cooking, and it's so delicious. It's kind of like baba ganoush without having to, like, char an eggplant for
too long. These charred stems you can mush up into baba ganoush. That is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So is there any quicker way to caramelize onions rather than slowly on a pan for, like, hours?
Yes, I actually learned this trick. I've never written about this, but my friend Anita Shepherd, do you know her? She launched Anita's yogurt, which is a coconut milk yogurt.
Oh, yes,
She's amazing. I learn so much from her every time I watch her cook. She caramelizes onions a little bit higher heat, but she just constantly deglazes with whatever she has around, whether it's
liquid,
beer, or water, or wine, whatever.
And that speeds it up.
And that, because you're constantly deglazing whatever's sticking to the pan, and it's getting, like, those flavors are getting absorbed into the onions.
Sweet.
And it just kind of allows you to go a little bit faster without burning anything.
Oh, literally, sweet. risotto, do I really need to toast the grains first in oil?
Yes.
Okay, that helps it be al dente.
I mean, it definitely helps with flavor, and I'm sure that it helps, too, with, like...
texture.
I think Elizabeth David said you're supposed to make them, like, impregnated with oil before you start adding or butter.
All right.
Before you start adding... I know, it's very,
those,
like,
Arborio rice grains. That sounds very Elizabeth David, actually.
Yes.
Beets, boil them or roast them?
Oh, gosh. I would say roast.
Yeah.
Or, if you cut them smaller, you don't have to wait as long. You can put them in a pan. Or you can just eat them raw, which is really more likely what I'm going to do.
Okay. Yeah, especially in this heat. Last but not least, how do I glaze nuts without having the sticky, caramelizy, burnty, you know,
so
up to the pan?
There is a recipe in this book, which you may have seen from Union Square Cafe, that is not, it's not a candied nut, it's like a spiced nut, and it's so much easier, and you don't end up with, like, burnt nonsense on the pan. It's just, you just toast the nuts and then you toss them in this really
toss
them separately, then you toss them in just a few things.
That's what I've been doing wrong.
Brown sugar, cayenne, melted butter, rosemary, I think, and salt. And then you still get the, like, sticky, salty goodness, but and sweetness from the brown sugar, but you don't, it just kind of, like, sits. It, like, clings to the outside of the nut.
And you won't lose,
like,
a pan.
Yeah, and you don't have to deal with
Brilliant.
With soaking a pan for a round.
All right. Thank you so much for indulging this round of questions.
Thank you. I hope it was rapid fire enough.
we'll get back to some more less rapid questions right after a quick little commercial interlude.
Before you're dead and gone,
dead and
no, there ain't no telling. Yeah, we all just bet, just plan our hand till the last stand. So,
the following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards and Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
All right, we're back chatting with Kristen McGlory of Food 52 and the latest cookbook, Genius Recipes, 100 Recipes That Will Change the Way You Cook. Kristen, it's so great to have you in the station.
It's really fun being here.
And been bearing with us, technical issues aside. So let's just go with, you know, what immediately should I make this week? Like, what's a great recipe
this
for this heat?
This week, guacamole.
Okay.
For sure. Or maybe, so there's the guacamole, Roberto Santibanez's guacamole is just like a really smart, only like slightly different kind of guacamole that makes a huge difference, just by the technique that you use.
What's weird about it?
So it has totally normal ingredients. It's just onion, chili, cilantro, avocado, salt, optional lime. Mm-hmm. But you mash up the onion, chili, and cilantro into a paste instead of leaving them chunky.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like a dressing for the avocado.
Ooh.
So, and it's, you know, super quick, really good.
I never thought of doing that, but that
degree
sounds
weather.
Great.
Yeah, and then you leave the avocado kind of chunky, so that's like half of what's so great about avocado is the texture, so.
You still have that chunkiness. Mm-hmm. It looks beautiful here, and with like, it reminds me of, you know, sometimes people are fond of making a cilantro sauce or like a cilantro oil.
Yeah, it is.
To have
it's
that
kind of like a
beautiful
like a
green
mojo or something like that.
Cool. And what's the best way? I noticed you have a hummus recipe from some serious pros here, Otto Lange and Sammy Tamimi. That sounds kind of like tahini. I mean, is there? I for me, when I'm making hummus, it's all about the texture. I can't really do too well. How can I overcome that if I'm a home cook?
So this is a seriously genius technique. And I think they were the first to ever really do it or ever publish about it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people will soak their chickpeas. They'll either soak or simmer the dried chickpeas with baking soda, and that helps soften the chickpeas. It makes it like an alkaline environment for them, and that's beans respond to that as opposed to like an acidic environment. That's why people always say you're not supposed to cook beans with like tomatoes or, you know, vinegar or something, because it keeps them very stiff.
Crumbly?
Yeah, it keeps them from softening. It takes a really long time for them to soften. So people do the opposite of that by putting in baking soda to make it alkaline. But theirs is even better because you saute, so you soak them normally with water overnight, and then you drain them, and then you kind of saute them for a few minutes with the baking soda directly, and that just, like, that direct contact with the baking soda makes their skins just kind of, like, slough off. Like, they just, and the skins are what makes it tough.
Yeah, you don't want that in your hummus.
Yeah, and so, and it also just kind of, like, permeates them a little bit more and helps them cook faster. This hummus, like, normally chickpeas would take, I think, close to, I don't know, an hour and a half or so to soften if you just simmered them straight, depending on the age of the chickpeas.
Yeah.
But this, I forget how long it takes, like 20 minutes, 20, 30 minutes of simmer time.
Yeah, 20 to 40 minutes.
Yeah.
That's really good. What if I use canned chickpeas? Am I ever going to attain that texture?
Can I cook it longer? You know, I haven't tried it.
Yeah.
But I don't think so. My gut is that they've already been processed to a certain extent in the canning process.
True.
They're already cooked.
They probably have some acidic things going on in there, too, to help preserve it. I don't know. Maybe that's something for listeners out there to try.
Mm-hmm.
So one question I have is, you know, when you're looking at recipes, before you even make it, is there any indicators of whether it's genius or not in all your experience? Because I know a lot of people, when you look up a recipe for, say, chocolate cake, and it's hard to test the quality of what's out there nowadays online. It wasn't always from a test kitchen scenario. Certainly my recipes are not, but I can tell you the good, the bad, the ugly. But, is there any indicators when you're looking at a recipe that would help tell you if it's a really trustworthy, good recipe?
That's a tough question. Like, it is really hard to know when you're looking online. You know, even looking at reviews, like, yes, you can read through the content of the comments, and, you know, there's a good chance that if there's a lot of people who've had success, then you're probably going to...
Right, the comments, you know, that's true.
Yeah, you can see... But the thing is, everybody's kitchens are different, and everybody's stove is different, every pan is different. So, just because you see a few reviews that... say this didn't work for me, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad recipe, but it is something good to keep in mind. Like, what might they have done differently? Or if they say, oh, I tried making this recipe, but I subbed in gluten-free pasta and it was terrible, or something like that. Like, you can kind of take that with a grain of salt. Like,
or
all right,
if they
maybe
sound
I'll...
like a total food blog troll, yes. You can maybe...
Yeah, watch out for the trolls.
Well, okay, so, it's hard to tell, but you guys are doing a great job of testing and putting out, like, the best of the best. So, speaking of which, let's talk about roast chicken a moment.
Sure.
This recipe is really interesting, and you said it's something that you can memorize without having to look at any recipes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is, if I remember, let me test my own memory. It is 500 degrees the whole time and 10 minutes to each pound of that bird.
Yep, you got it. Yep, you don't need a recipe anymore. The only other thing you need to know is that don't truss it.
Don't truss it?
Don't truss it.
Okay.
Leave its legs just
anyway.
Hanging out there, and put the legs towards the back of the oven because that's the hottest place. And they take the longest to cook through. So this is why, why do we truss things? Like,
I don't know.
So because the legs and the thighs are the part that takes the longest, the dark meat takes the longest to cook through. So why are we bundling it up? Close to, you know, I never thought about that too hard, but until I read Barbara Kafka's book on roasting, and she's so right. She said that it's a relic from when we used to roast things over spits.
Yes.
And so, like,
you don't want them flapping out.
Exactly, like, you don't want them
apart.
To just, like, char completely.
Right, right.
And so you tuck them into...
Ew.
And you're dealing with much higher temperatures.
What about the wings? Because I know the wing tips could burn and I hear that you should tuck them behind their back.
You can either tuck them or you can clip off the very end. But, like, I usually just leave them and they don't burn so badly that you don't want to kind of gnaw on them.
So there's also, I think in your introduction you mentioned that nowadays we prefer this more kind of golden and not even golden, but actually brown, like bronzed color to roast chicken and many other things. Like, we seem to lean towards, I guess, the Maillard reaction in a lot of our foods today. And so maybe that has changed the way we look at the perfect roast chicken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So 500 degrees, though, I don't know if I've ever done chicken at that high heat, but...
the only thing that can go wrong is that some people have complained that it can get very smoky, spattery.
Oh, no.
And so some people have said, like, oh, my smoke alarm was going off, but she's just, like, unplug your smoke alarm temporarily while you're cooking this. But Cooks Illustrated also came up with a good tip, which is the thing that's mostly spattering is not the skin of the bird, but the juices and the fat that's coming off into the bottom of the pan.
Yeah.
And so they recommend putting like thinly sliced potatoes or something like that that can absorb the fat and the juices and not kind of give it this like playground to just like get crazy fatter, you know, the water and oil hitting into each other and being explosive. So that's what I do now. I just like throw whatever vegetables I have under the chicken and it doesn't...
Something that'll soak it up, right?
Yeah. So that sounds... And then you get the bonus of like this really good
delicious schmaltzy,
whatever you've put in the bottom.
Sounds great. Mm-hmm. We're just about out of time, Kristen, but is there any favorite recipe or favorite genius revelation of yours?
Oh, man.
I know. I guess the book is favorites, but...
It's like my babies. Like, how do you pick a favorite child? But no, I really like the ones that are the most shocking. I have kind of like a soft spot for the things that you just like... are just like the total opposite of what you would think.
Okay.
Like, for example, I'm going to probably say his name in a really like embarrassing way, but Hervé Thys.
Who's
the,
that?
Hervé Thys. Okay. He's the man behind, he invented the word molecular gastronomy.
Oh, right.
And
yes.
His chocolate mousse recipe is, it's not like a traditional chocolate mousse cream and eggs and everything. Mm-hmm. It's literally just chocolate and water, which are not supposed to be able to mix. Like, water is supposed to make chocolate seize, and so you're supposed to be very careful in chocolate work. But he figured out that if you just melt chocolate and water together in a certain proportion, and then cool it off and whisk as it's cooling, it kind of acts like a cream or like something that you can whip, like an emulsified mixture.
To make it lighter and stretch it.
Because, you know, cream is basically an emulsification of fat and
water,
milk, you know, so this is kind of like making a cream out of chocolate and water. But it's vegan. It's crazy.
That is crazy. I've heard of this too. I think, a lot of people are doing this now, thanks to him, and thanks to... This recipe looks super easy, too, and I hate seeing, like, dessert recipes with, like, a huge, long list of things to do, so this looks, like, really nicely
refined. Yeah, it's a
refined,
fun one.
So.
It's a shocker.
Wow. All right. Thank you so much, Kristen. And, we'll look forward to reading on more genius recipes to come through your column.
Thank you so much.
Maybe another volume, too.
Maybe.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. And thanks for everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.